Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a rousing Tulare County welcome for our warm-up speaker, Helen.
Kind of nervous up here. All you people looking up here at me. My name is Helen and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Helen.
I'm grateful to be here tonight and grateful to be sober. And I have 10 minutes to share with you the goodness and grace that I've been given through this program. I've been given a life. My family, I have a community, respect, family respect, friends, and I got all of that from this fellowship, from this program, from the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I first got sober in 1987, and but before I got sober in 1987, I was in and out of the programs. I would get so bad and so, you know, when they talk about that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, I would, you know, participate in that on and off. And then when it get too bad, I would go check myself into a hospital or into a recovery home. And there was this guy, every time I go to this one particular recovery home, they take us to a meet-in. You have to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And we were at this meeting a lot, and this guy, they called him Shorty, and he's not alive anymore, but he would see me come in, and he would say, "It's an inside job." I had no idea what he was saying to me, but when I finally surrendered to this fellowship, to this program, I realized that it was an inside job, and that the work that I had to do in order to stay sober, it started from the inside. I had to change my thinking. I had to change the people I hung out with, the places I go. You know, I had to change a lot about myself, and Shorty was right. I got sober, and I stayed sober for 10 years, and then I, in that 10 years, I went back to school. I became a drug and alcohol counselor. I was program coordinator for one of the programs I had went through, and I worked as a case manager for Drug and Alcohol Treatment Center. And I knew how to stay sober. So when my sponsor left and went out of town, and I moved out away from my support group, I stopped going to meetings. You know, I kind of like felt like I can do it myself. You know, I know how to stay sober. I know the 12 core functions of alcoholism, of addiction. I knew all that stuff. And I stopped doing the things that kept me being sober. I stopped going to meetings. I stopped working with others. I stopped, I lost that spiritual contact that we must have in order to stay sober. I lost that. And I relapsed. I relapsed not on alcohol at first, but pills. And I had a foot surgery. No, my mother died. I had a foot surgery. And I got married. And I woke up like, oh my God, I'm married. I didn't know how to be. I didn't know how to, you know, even in that 10 years that I was sober, I didn't know how to be in a relationship. But I found myself married, and I had to deal with it, and it was difficult. with the drugs and with the alcohol and with the new husband, and I gave into it. I started to, and it's almost as if I picked up where I left off at. I just started back, and you know, I just worked this way up, and then the next thing you know, I'm running all over town trying to get pills. I had my alcohol was right there because we kept it in the house, and I just kept drinking it. My husband, he doesn't drink, so he didn't know that the bottles were missing, you know, was going down, down, down. And I was surprised to see those bottles, the content of those bottles go down, down, down. But I was drinking it, you know. And so I got to the point where I wanted to be, I lost my freedom. I wanted my freedom back. And I couldn't have that freedom as long as I was drinking and using. I didn't have freedom. And I wanted my freedom back. I knew what it was like to be sober, to be able to go and come as you please and not have someone or have something holding you back. My husband and I went out of town once. We were in New York, and I didn't have anything. I didn't have pills, and I couldn't drink because my husband think I'm sober, you know. So I couldn't drink, and I was just miserable. And I was thinking about how I got to where I was, and then that feeling of guilt, the shame. I felt that I couldn't go back into the rooms of NA, so I would just hang out in AA, and then, I went to church. Let me back that up. I decided I go to church, and I'm going to become a church member, and because it's all about that contact with God, right? So I'm going to go to church, and I'm going to be, me and God, we're going to be okay. And it doesn't work like that. The only thing that I know that will keep me sober is these rooms, these steps, these traditions. People like me, you know, we keep each other sober. And so I went back into the hospital and got, before I went back in the hospital, I was in Las Vegas, and I was sitting on a bar stool, and I was full of pills and booze. And my girlfriend, I kept some contacts in the fellowship, and one of my girlfriends called and she said, "Are you okay? I was just thinking about you." And I said, "Oh yeah, I'm in Vegas and having a great time." And then God stepped in. I called her back and I said, "No, I'm in trouble. I need help." And she says, "When are you going home?" I told her. So a couple of days later, I went home and I downed this bottle of wine. And the next day, I downed that bottle of wine all by myself. And the next day, I couldn't figure out why I couldn't raise my head up off the pillow. And the phone kept ringing. And I was in the house by myself. And then they were banging on the door. And so my husband had left. I didn't know where he was, but I went to the door. It was my girlfriend and another friend, and they were there to do an intervention. And the phone rang, and it was my husband, and he says, I was talking to him and talking to the people at the door, and he says, "Who is that?" I said, "Some Jehovah's Witnesses, you know." They're just trying to get me a track or something. So anyway, my friend said, "Call it." I hung up the phone. She said, "Call him back." And then she said, is there any coffee?" Then I knew it was an intervention. I said, "Coffee." They asked for coffee. And I went and made coffee. And we went out in the backyard and we discussed it. And I went into the hospital. They had it all set up for me. And when those are friends from the fellowship, friends. And they had it all set up for me. And I went into the hospital and I got clean, sober. And I was 2 years sober when I moved to Three Rivers. And in Three Rivers, meetings are important. Three Rivers, we had one meeting, and it was on a Monday night. And I, first of all, I had to get over the culture shock of Three Rivers. It's like, God, how did I get here? But I'm here, so we're going to make the best of it. And so there was a Monday night meeting, and I only got to make that meeting twice because of the other two Mondays I was down in Los Angeles. So I'm just walking, going back and forth and to Los Angeles and not going to meetings and not talking to anyone in the fellowship. I met one person in the fellowship who stuck with me in Three Rivers, and she kept bugging me and bugging me. Anyway, one day I get up out of my bed. Nothing's going on. Everything seemed to be okay. I walk right by my dresser, and my husband had a bottle of pain pills there. I mean, the sun was shining. I had no guilt, no remorse, no anything. I just walked by and picked it up because it was, you know, like mine. And it was off. I was off and running again. And then I wanted to be free. I wanted my sobriety. I wanted my freedom. I hated having something have that much hold on me. And so I went back to meetings, and I was going down on Bridge Street. I'd go, they said there was no meetings, only one meeting in Three Rivers, and if you can't do that, then go down to Bridge Street. And I was going to Bridge Street at least two or three times a week, and I was grateful to be there. I remember I was so grateful to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to wash cups when I got there. I wanted to wash cups, but the secretary looked at me so funny. It's like he was waiting on us to leave. I had my girlfriend washing cups in that meeting, you know, because that's what we used to do when I first came in. You know, you have the greeters, and you have those who wash cups, you have people to empty the cigarette cans. I wanted to wash cups because I wanted to show the people, Alcoholics Anonymous, how grateful I was to be back. And in this program, when I relapsed, my first relapse, my mother had died. I lost my job, and I had my foot surgery, blah, blah, blah. But in the last 4 years in this program, being sober, I buried two sons. And I did not have to drink or use over it. Drinking and using was not an option for me. I knew I had to feel the feelings. I had to walk through it. And with the help of my sisters and brothers in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm walking through it. I'm facing it. And this program is so beautiful. My younger son, when he came here, is my time up? Yeah. When my younger son got sick, he came home to me. He left his wife, he came to his mother. I was upset with him, but he wanted to be home. So he ended up in the hospital, and he had to have his leg amputated. And I called my sponsor, and we talked about it, and she told me about someone in the fellowship who also had their legs amputated. And I called him and asked him if he would go meet me at the hospital so he could talk to my son and give him some hope. You know, there's hope. Hope in this fellowship. We have hope. So I was surprised that this man came up to me and at the hospital. He walked into my son's hospital room with me in shorts, and my son got to see him, and it really did give him hope. You know, unfortunately, it wasn't for my son to get well. He passed away, and when he passed away, I got a call that morning saying that on a Friday morning, my husband and I and another member of this fellowship, we were downstairs talking about how well my son was doing and how we had just, everyone had, when the last time they saw him. But what we didn't know was that he had already passed, and that that morning, and the hospital, it kept calling me, but my phone, the ringer was off. So when I realized my ringer was off, I went and I turned it back on, and I called a member of this fellowship to go with me to the hospital, to drive me, and she drove me there and stayed with me, and we made the arrangements. And then about a couple weeks later, I was at an outing in Three Rivers, and there was a woman who walked up to me, and she said, "You're Helen?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "I wanted you to know that I was the nurse who was with your son the day he passed, and I want you to know that I did pray for him." And it was, she told me, she said, she helped me to accept that he was ready to go. She said that Thursday night he was getting sick, and she asked him, did he want to go to the hospital? And he told her no, that there was nothing else they could do for him. And he passed about 6 o'clock that morning. And when she told me that, it just blessed my soul, you know, just to know that someone was there caring for him, who knew me, who knew the program, who knew God, you know. I got that from this program. Being sober, I have a community of friends. I have an unlimited pipeline of friends, and I'm grateful for being here. I guess that's about it with me. I'm just grateful. I'm just grateful to be sober, grateful to have God in my life, grateful that I met God in this fellowship, because I didn't find the God of my understanding in the church. I got him here. And thank you for letting me share.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a rousing Tulare County welcome for our featured speaker, Alcoholic Andy. How you doing, Alcoholic Andy? So, that name was appointed to me, and then I became that name, you know, Mr. AA. So my story's kind of bland. You know, I'm glad you guys all showed up. Hope I don't bore you too much. Alcoholics Anonymous not only turned my life around, but it allowed me to do a lot more than I ever imagined. It's a life-changing experience. Is anybody new here, brand new? You know, that's within the first 10 years?
First 10 years, yeah.
Well, I got sober October 5th, 1987. I was 26. First meeting I went to, you know, you people needed my help. You know, day three, I was appointed a sponsor. And right after that, a guy named Ron said, "Alcoholic Andy." And I was like, "No, I'll just be Andy. I'm an alcoholic." He says, no, this would be great for you. And it just kind of turned out that way. And then a lot of people call me Cowboy Andy. You know, if you want to find me on the internet, it's A.W. Clark. So I believe in my anonymity. I was told early, when you go to the doctor, don't tell them you're an alcoholic. Insurance companies, don't tell them you're an alcoholic. And it kind of stuck with me a little bit, you know, because I was still
I was unemployable, meaning I was kind of in the professional world but couldn't hold a job. And I don't care what you think of yourself now, but when you're a drunkard, everybody already knows you. And so to spread that around, because that's the appearance that you've carried most of your life. You're a drunkard, you can't show up on time, you're no good, you won't hold a job very long. And so for me, it was important to remain anonymous. You know, it's an interesting concept. I love the concept of anonymity, to where I don't have to be anybody else, that when I walk into the room of an Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'm just another drunk. I'm not special. I don't care how many years I got, I can still learn something from somebody brand new. Now, there is that part of wisdom, you know, the bleeding deacons, I love them. Elder statesmen, I like them more. You know, the people who really know this program, who have got in and kind of studied it a little bit. You know, a sponsor who has a sponsor is probably important. I was appointed my sponsor day three. You know, I come from a little town called Exeter, born and raised, went to Lemon Cove Schools, you know, had four stepdads. The wonder for my life that I'm so appreciative is my parents got divorced when I was about eight. And Dad had four boys every other week. And what do you do with four boys every other weekend? Especially after the sun goes down. And him being who he is, he's figured, we'll play cards. And him being who he is, I love him. He says, we're gonna drink while we play cards. And so I learned to drink before as a teenager. I learned not to puke before as a teenager. Didn't make me an alcoholic. You know, the book talks about the difference between a problem drinker and alcoholic. I was not alcoholic at that point. I learned how to drink before I got to high school. So by the time they kicked me out of high school for drinking, I was able to go to work at a bar. 17-year-old bartending. Because I didn't giggle and I didn't puke. I knew how to make most of the drinks. What a greater gift for a guy like me. You know, to be able to be in the element that I loved. Full-blown alcohol all around. So anyway, they kicked me out of high school. They let me kind of back in. I didn't have consequences, really. It was at the end of the year, and they let me come back for my senior year, and they said, the only time you can be on campus is from 9 to 10 o'clock in the morning for American government. We still had civics back then. I don't know. You know, they don't teach it much anymore. But then, and it was interesting to me, but it allowed me to get a job down on Main Street in Exeter that had a back door. So not only did I have a job, but I became a great entrepreneur too. If you know what happens out the back door when you're a kid. You know? And I thought it was the best thing that ever happened, because when it came around time for graduation and scholarships, I had all the time in the world to sign up for scholarships. Now, I got to tell you, there were some parents in Exeter, California in 1979 that didn't appreciate me being kicked out of school and getting 17 scholarships. I had the time. See, there wasn't any consequences for me. I was the kind of kid, they tell me, that would go to school drunk, couldn't see through the slits in your eyes, and know the answers. Homework was just something to do. It wasn't hard. I figure I was gifted, right? So I went to COS, and then I had teachers that hated my guts. But I got straight A's. And then the teacher in chemistry that blew his fingers off while we were making C4, I was his favorite student in chemistry, because he would get lost on the three chalkboards. And I would be like four chapters ahead, and he'd say, Clark, what did I do wrong? Because it's not working out. Now, this is chemicals, right? This one attaches here. It's a tertiary bond. It's way over your heads, I understand. Sorry. But if you're a good alcoholic, you know about chemistry. Come on. You like chemistry. Anyway, for me, it was a great time, because I sold my homework, I Xeroxed them off, and he didn't give a shit, and handed them out for $10 every morning to 22 different students in the class, and they gave me $10, and it was my homework Xerox for him. And he didn't care. And this is the same guy who could appreciate me being who I was. Red-eyed, drunk half the time. And he and the teacher that got kicked out of high school with me, he lost his credentials. They wrote a special letter to Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and I got in there. It was a wonderful deal for me. You know, that's where my grandmother paid for my brothers to go to Fresno State. And I thought she was kind of disrespectful for me. And I said, I'm going to Cal Poly. She says, we're a Fresno State family, and if you go anywhere else, you won't get a dime. And I didn't get a dime. Shit. She says, by the way, if you put yourself through college, quit drinking. Now, this is the same grandma that, after I had a kid, would come down to the bar, talk about that pitiful and incomparable, invincible demoralization. Have your grandma come down to the bar and say, Andrew, come with me. Shit, grandma, I'm drinking a beer with my friends. You have kids at home, and I just had to drop off diapers for your wife. It's like, oh, come on. She's got a job. She can't buy diapers. I'm out of plumb, right? Got a little twisted here going on here. Anyway, so, you know, by the time I'm 21 and able to drink, I had a lot of bars and bartenders pissed off at me because I'd go in and say, give me my free drink. You've been drinking here for 4 years. What do you mean 21? For an alcoholic like me, it was good. I didn't have consequences with my drinking. Until, I don't know when it was exactly. You know, I've heard other people talk about it, but for me, it was like, oh shit! Once you step over the line into alcoholism, I couldn't get back. I had a wedding in a carport at a duplex with a judge up front. It's alcoholic, right? Keg in the garage. And she was perfectly happy with it, you know, little oaky gal. But everybody else went, really? Really? And I just so happened to have a neighbor across the street who was a sheriff who got off like at 3 in the morning. And me and another guy are still sitting there drinking the keg because there was still beer, right? And he come over and he says, I'll have a drink with you. He says, how many have you had? I said, we're going to finish this keg. He says, you ever heard of tolerance? He's like, how many have you had? I said, half that keg. He says, you're not drunk at all. I'm a cop. I can see you're not drunk. That's tolerance. I said, yeah, but last week I went down to the bar and drank 2 beers and couldn't stand up. He says, that's the problem when you drink too much. And it didn't sink in, guys. It didn't sink in. And so a wonderful thing happened to me February 1st, 1984. It was actually January 31st, right? I went down to my favorite bar, the Stag in Exeter, after drinking all day. And I'm playing a little bit of Alpaw, shooting craps, bought my own big bottle of Crown Royal. Susie 86'd me from my own bottle. But I had friends, right? You guys have friends. And they would have her pour them a shot, and they slide it to me. Slide it back. I was drunk. I don't remember. But anyway, I happened to miss the turn into the alley and ran into a ditch. 7 hours later, my roommate found me and said there was something dead in the house. It was me. And they took me to the hospital, cut me open before anesthesia, and pronounced me dead, so to speak. And a great event in my life. See, I fooled those doctors. They told the nurse to go get a certificate. And they walked over to wash their hands, took their gloves off, put their hands underneath the water. And the heart monitor went beep-deep, beep-deep. And they both turned around and went, and both doctors told me 6 months to a year later the same story separately. And as long as one of them kept their hand underneath the water, the other one could work on me. The best thing that ever happened to me, I feel sorry for you people, I don't have a memory of all the guilt and shame that happened prior to that date. So my 4-step was a little bit different than most people's. I didn't have all that bullshit. You know, I know that I was told mistruths that still haunt me today. I believe in stuff that people told me that are absolutely not true. But I didn't have all that guilt from high school and this and that. I thank God he erased it from me. And so for me, I had guys bringing me whiskey in the hospital. Now, I had just had major surgery. The doctor said he got a cramp, massage in my heart. They had shocked me a whole bunch of times, and they called it. And then they had to go back to work for me. Dr. Gensler was a Seventh-day Adventist guy. He says, I just practice medicine. It just goes to prove I'm not God. And it's like, cool. He says, now let me tell you something about you, though. He says, you were a pickle when I first met you. And we made you an olive. Because they had to put saline in me to absorb all the alcohol out of my system. He says, son, you'll never be a cucumber again. And it didn't sink in, right? I still continue to drink. I switched from whiskey because it made me puke to one of my favorites, square bottle green. It comes from Mexico called mezcal. Because I'm kind of that John Wayne guy, right? I can't drink tequila. I got to drink mezcal. And it became my favorite drink. I love Coors and mezcal. Before that, I loved Crown Royal and Coors. But I switched, and God, that poor woman that I was married to, she put up with me. I got Mike in the front row. He was around in the early days. He got to see where I got married in that garage with an open, no door on it, packed full of my shit. That's just the way I lived. You know, it was just a little duplex, but you couldn't park a car in there for my stuff. And he kind of shook his head then. It was interesting. Anyway, so for me, it took 2.5-3 years for me to, after a sufficient reason for anybody else in the whole world to quit drinking. They pronounced me dead for drinking. I couldn't quit drinking. I had crossed over that imaginary line and could not quit. I became a binge drinker. So, you know, the guilt that was about me, the grandma things, the wife things, if you just quit drinking, things would be better. And I couldn't quit. So I would go a couple weeks, and then all of a sudden, Thursday night, 7 o'clock, don't you want to go where everybody knows your name? Just draw me in. And I'd say, honey, I'm going to go down and have a couple beers. And she'd say, good. Do that before you make us miserable too. Because I'm the kind of guy, when I get that itch to drink, I will make you miserable to get my way. You know, it's called immaturity. But I will create a fight. I'll cause a problem. And you will tell me to leave. And then I get my way. And so I get my way and I go down. And, you know, you went for 2 beers. Now it's 2 o'clock in the morning. You left at 10. Doesn't take that long to drink 2 beers. But in my mind, you're already in trouble. How much more trouble is going to be? So that would be Thursday. Now, Friday morning at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, you're already in trouble. So Monday morning when I went home, I figured I was in just about enough trouble that I could get away with it. So I was a binge drinker. I could not quit. And once I took a drink, who knows what was going to happen. It's just, Andy was going to be gone. And she kind of reserved to that, right? Had... You know, the brothers, the mothers, the dads. If you just quit drinking. I'm working on it. Couldn't quit drinking. Once I got the itch, it had to be scratched. And once I took the first sip, who knows what was going to happen. I love to wreck cars. That's my MO. Drinking and driving was natural. But the wrecking of the cars. I wrecked a 68 Firebird. Totaled it 7 times. I wish I had that car back. Worth about $30,000 now. It was straight six, 24 valve overhead. It's a hell of an engine. But the insurance company decided that they weren't going to give it to me back. I had the same problem with a dog bite one time. You can either have insurance or you can have them dogs. They said you can have insurance or you can have that car. And as the car is driving away on the tow truck, friend of mine, Jerry Farney, down the road, comes back and says, go get that car. They will give it back. Find a way to give it back. The engine's worth $5,000 on a car that I paid $1,300 for. It was the best thing that ever happened to me. Because I'd probably be dead again, right? Fast cars and me just don't agree. First of all, I don't know how to drive right. So Gia tells me, drive like an old man. There's a reason for that. Trying to save your ass and mine. Anyway, so, you know, kind of fast forward, I was off on another bender, and I came home, and she said, you can't stay here. I'm done. I was like, well, okay. Because, see, for years, I've been able to weasel my way back in. And there weren't really consequences. You know, another couple days off, I got this hangover, I don't want to hear yelling and screaming at me. It'd be fine. So I ended up at my dad's house in Three Rivers, slept it off for a while, and he had a full bar, but I was in search of a Coors. And luckily my stepmother had hidden two Coors lights underneath the lettuce in the crisper. That took some searching, right? But I found them. And I opened up the first one and took that. Oh, I still love that sound. And I like that first. It's not a swallow, guys. It's not a sip. And then you're back to where you're you again, right? Well, me. And I went over to that phone on the wall. And this is how long ago that was. Yeah. I said, hey, what are you doing? And she says, you're fucking drinking again. Now, this is 30 miles away on a telephone. You want to talk about a psychic change? It's instant for me. I become a different person. Book calls it Jekyll and Hyde. I call it Andrew and Andy. Two different people. Same person. And it just so happened to hit me wrong. And I said, bitch. Oh, and it was enough guilt that I walked over to the sink and poured it out. That was stupid. But there's another one in the crisper. And this is where it gets interesting for me, because people say, you know, it's okay for you to have a relationship with God, but don't tell us about Him talking to you personally. I got the next one out, and I cracked it open, and I got to here, and it wouldn't go no further. And God said, there are no more, the beer did. Okay, it's easier. The beer told me, there are no more answers in here for you. And it made me cry, because I knew it was right. I wasn't getting anything out of it anymore. And so I poured it out, and I called her, and I said, you win. I win what?
Because they got to make you say it, right?
I went, what? And I said, you know that rehab shit you've been talking about? You know, back then it was the rolling hills of Kingsburg. Bring your toothbrush and your underwear. We got you covered. I hated to see that shit on TV. Because about every third commercial was that commercial in my life. Now, it wasn't, but to me, it was, because the world was against me, right? And anyway, she said, okay, impact, Gwen Delta, 8 o'clock in the morning. Now, people who know me, I'm not an early riser. And it was the first compromise I probably ever did in my entire life. I said, how about 10? She said, 8 o'clock in the morning. I said, how about 9? She says, I'll see you there at 9, you'll be an hour late. And I showed up at 9. And it changed my life. I got to tell you. I bought a hook, line, and sinker. You people needed my help. I didn't know that it was that serious at the time. See, my sponsor that was appointed at day 3 said, you got to realize, this is the most selfish, self-centered group of people you're ever going to be around. You got to realize they're selfish and self-centered. And you're bad enough, they can help you. How is that going to work? See, I didn't realize the extent of the condition my condition was in. I was screwed up, guys. And so what happened is I jumped in, learned to parrot you, became a star. People wanted to hear me talk. Besides those people in the foothill groups that I went to that said, I spilt more beer on my tie than you've ever drank in your life, young man. And I'm a farmer. I rarely wear a tie. Why don't you shut up and listen to us for a while? Because you have no idea what we're talking about. We know how to drink. But please be quiet for a while. And I couldn't help myself. I'd have to interject. And they would roll their eyes. And they'd listen to me. Thank God for the guys like that. You know, the old guys that I can see right now that are you. Same people. You know, it's just I don't hear you guys talking about, you know, I've had that 15 acres unplanted for 15 years, and I think I'm going to plant it in Satsumas. That was Rick's comment tonight at dinner. So it's the same people. Or, you know, the Ferns that said, you know, I had to quit drinking when my dog started talking to me, and I started answering. That's Mike sitting over here. You know, it's a wonderful, wonderful program. So what happened for me after I decided to surrender, and I never surrendered still yet today, but I've made the attempt, is, you know, I started going to meetings, started listening, made a few friends, had a sponsor appointed to me that I did not use. It was nice to have somebody that I could say, yeah, I got a sponsor. Didn't use him. But at about a year and 3 days, that woman said, you know what, you're gone now more than you were drinking. Because now I wasn't a binge meeting goer. I was a 7 day a week. But the meetings that I went to, people can attest, I love to talk after the meeting. The meeting after the meeting is the most favorite part for me. But I would stay out till 3 o'clock in the morning. And you got that woman at home with the juju eye. They don't trust you coming home at 3 o'clock in the morning. You're supposed to be sober. Don't you got to go to work tomorrow? No, I lost that job. And so, you know, for me, she just wasn't respecting me. I had a year sober. Just got a birthday cake. They let me talk. And they said 20 minutes, but I took my 40 because I deserved it. I had a year. And so I said, I had a job. The guy offered me a job. I was working. And I said, I'm leaving. I'm sober, and you don't respect me. She said, I kind of liked you. You were less of an asshole when you were drinking. At least I can control you once in a while with guilt. She didn't say that, but that's what they mean. So, I've wanted. Well, yeah, I understand. I'm digging a hole. It's fine. I wanted it all. You know, she was really pissed off when I said, give me that electric bill. I'll pay it now. Now, I'm unemployable, guys. I'm self-employed. I make money when I make money. But I thought I could take those pants back that she'd been wearing for 6 years. Become a big boy, huh? She didn't like that very much. And so she said, okay, you can do that. And then I couldn't make the bill. Come on, big boy. God, what we learned in sobriety. My sponsor used to tell me, you know, you were a soaring eagle out there drinking. We just clipped your wings. Now you're going to have to become responsible and live up to the words that you've been telling people. So if you're new, run now. Run. Yeah. If you can still possibly drink at all, I suggest you try it until you can. But if you can't stop drinking and want to, guess what comes in? You're going to feel better. You're going to feel misery better. You're going to feel sadness better. You're going to feel everything better. Not just the good shit, but the bad shit comes along with it too, better. And then they're going to make you responsible. And the electric bill comes in, you're going, oh shit, I ain't got the money. And pay it just as soon as you can. Because there's nothing worse for an alcoholic than being sober and then shut off your electricity. How do you explain that shit? Because I'm sober now. It's an interesting deal. So for me, I took AA by storm. Right? I became a star. Secretary. Well, the Foothill groups, you know, there's six guys that go to the same meeting all over. And as soon as we get somebody with 6 months, you're it. You do this shit. And so, you know, there was secretaryship right away. They were a little bit more Stern back then. AA is a little softer today. Wouldn't let you talk for the first 30 days. Your sponsor actually suggested that. Shut up for 30 days. They wouldn't let you secretary at all until you had 6 months. Couldn't become a CSR for 2 years. So 2 years in a day. Because that's just, I wanted to be a part of. You know, what I wanted to do was control AA. And I didn't even know it. So I became a CSR, and then I became a GSR. If you really want to learn about egos, get into service work. That's how I learned about my ego the most. And then I was elected the DCM of Tulare, a District 47, Tulare. And I got to go to Sacramento. And I thought I was somebody better than anybody else in Tulare County, because I was the DCM right now. Until they told me, read the long form of the concepts, do you? Shrink. And then my service sponsor, old Joe over there, he was the delegate at the time. He says, I'm going to prep you to be the next delegate. And what we need to do is start the movement of making NICA into two districts. We want to split California. And you're the guy that can do it. And me, I'm like, I'm the guy that can do it. Now, I'm running for delegate and trying to take Sacramento's power away from it. Going to assemblies, going to service fairs, being Mr. AA. And I'm loving it. I didn't know how bad it looked. Nobody was tapping me on the back saying, be careful. You know, tradition six, you can't be AA. AA's itself. And so I get on the assembly floor and I make the motion. Now I've got John from Fresno, and I mean, these people are powerful in AA in Sacramento, and they're from down here, and they let me make the motion. And then they ask for a second. Kind of like this. Nobody knows what the hell we're talking about, and nobody seconds it. Yeah, thank you. So, anyway, and I walked away with my tail between my legs. Because I didn't know that I was running strictly on ego. That I wanted to be somebody so bad it didn't matter how I looked. And so, it taught me something. So I came back to Tulare County. I did a few more months of being DCM. And I had to say, you know what, I'm going to have to step away from taking care of AA. See, I didn't realize that AA takes care of itself all by itself. Now, I still have issues, you know, I love their traditions, I love the concepts. You know, I sometimes have a problem, but we pass around the pink and white can. That's an outside issue. Or that we say the Lord's Prayer after a meeting. Where's that come from? Somebody came up with a great idea, but is it AA? You know, outside issues are outside issues. You know, psychiatrists take care of all the rest of the shit that's in our heads. I had to go over once. AA is strictly about us drinking and how we relate to another alcoholic on an individual basis. Not in a meeting basis, but on an individual basis on how we quit drinking. Now, you can be in a meeting, but please try to, in my opinion, which I'm probably trying to save AA again, right? I'm usually taking my pitch to one or two individuals. The old timers really don't give a shit what I say. But the newcomers, I want to kind of take my pitch in a direction that will help them out. To where they'll learn that you can quit drinking. Being as screwed up as I am, I succeeded. Came in at 26 years old, and I'm still sober today. Never had to take another drink. That is a miracle in AA. It was a miracle for me. But my point is it takes a lot of learning. Nobody starts. Everybody starts at the same spot, from zero. You know, when you went to kindergarten, they told you 1 + 1 = 2, right? Same with AA. I sometimes expect a newcomer to know all this shit that took me 30 years to figure out. Bad me. Everybody starts at the beginning. They don't know all this shit. But what I suggest, if you're new, find a sponsor who's read the book, who has a sponsor that's working the steps on a regular basis. And attach yourself and pick his brain. Because that's what's going to educate you. You know, I love the sponsors that take their sponsees and read the book to them and discuss it. That's not me. I'm not that kind of sponsor. But there are those people out there who are willing to give up their time, the most important thing there is in the world to human beings. Because we only get someone to give of yourself to another human being without expecting anything. I expect shit in results, okay? But I think you guys don't expect shit in results. I expect results, but that's just me. But we give of ourselves to another human being. Did you ever think when you quit drinking, you were going to have to buy into this shit and do it? It is what saves our ass in the future. You know, it's interesting. I've been through a lot of ups and downs. I've been divorced twice in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I say that with pride today. First of all, I'm not the anchor on our sides. Probably holding them back a little bit. But I say that because for me, it taught me how to become rigorous honesty with myself. See, that's the point of even getting sober for me, is I've had to learn to be honest with myself. Not honest of what you're going to think. I'm thinking you're thinking you're thinking of me. But what God and I have in store for me and how I think of myself. And it just turned out that their selfishness was getting in the way of my selfishness. I had to cut them loose. Because that's the root of my problem. Selfish, self-centered, full of self-pity and self-fear. And so for me, when I realize that and have to step aside for a while, have to start a new chapter in my life, it's to save me. It's I don't know if you guys are as selfish as me, but this is all about me. And so for me, I've been divorced twice just because it wasn't working out for me. I don't know if it probably wasn't working out for them, but that's not the point. I'm the only one that's going to save my own ass. I can't, Helen said it, it's an inside joke. I cannot depend on somebody else to make me happy. Usually expectations come along and they make me unhappy. And then I get to throw a tantrum and an anger fit and tell them how they're not doing it right. No, it's up to me to make me happy. If I want to be happy, I have to find that within myself. Now the trick is to find a significant other, like I found, that can add to your happiness. Then you can laugh and cry and they're part of it. Instead of, you're my anchor, I'm your anchor, you're the boat I'm trying to climb in, and I'm going to pull you over with me. Because that shit happens. Seen it lots. If you're new, please give yourself and yourself alone a year in AA. Save my ass. Because there was lots of pretty large-breasted women that I hugged and loved. But I believe my sponsor, when he told me, he says, as sick as you are, and they want you, how sick does that make them?
Pull it out now. Pull it out. There. Because, see, I was just, and I didn't have any idea how sick I really was. It took years.
But I knew I was sick enough that I didn't need some other hostage to participate in my bullshit. And so, you know, AA is the best thing that ever happened. Church was pretty good for a while, you know. Lost my hat once, and I knew Bob went to church, and we bought the same hat straight together, went down, standing in the back, preacher sees me, cuts it short, comes back, says, I never believed that I'd see you in church here in our congregation. I'm like, well, I had a problem. He says, what was your problem? I said, well, I lost my hat. And Bob, before you converted him, we had the same hat. I know he comes to church and hangs his hat right back here. So yeah, I come to steal his hat. He says, but you didn't. What happened? Was it something I said? I said, yeah, something you said. He's like, was it the fire and brimstone? Nah, it was the ten commandments. Thou shalt not steal. No, it wasn't that one. He says, thou shalt not covet. No, it was that thing about adultery. He says, adultery? He says, yeah, remember where I lost my fucking hat? That's what I got out of church. You can get that at AA too. It's not what we're selling. You know, I've watched lots of people come into AA for alternative reasons. I've watched lots of people come in and they're going to find a significant other that's going to rescue them from the world. That's not what we're selling here. We're selling hope that you can rescue yourself. It's going to take some work. It's going to take some sadness. It's going to take some self-seeking, internal search. My morals were shot. Shot. Even after I was in AA, they were shot. Didn't know nothing. I mean, please don't let me put my morals on you. First of all, you're starting way over here. But we do that, don't we? We can't really allow people to make their own decisions. But if we help them up and try to express where our pitfalls are, or direct them to somebody, God, see that guy, he went through the same shit you're going through. I love to do that. People come and ask me to sponsor, and I have room for, I've had sponsors for 20 years now. They're 20 years old. It's not my success, it's God's success. But today, it's iffy on whether I want to, but I know people that can help you. I will direct you. When it says, anytime somebody reaches for the hand of AA, I hope somebody's there. It doesn't mean me. It means I might direct you to somebody else. Because the hand of AA is there. I understand they may have more than I do to offer you. You know, I had to quit being Mr. Know-it-all, Mr. AA. Now, I still have a lot of shit. You know, Rick told me about a month ago, you're going to do this. Because the person you set up to do it is not doing it, so you're going to do it. which is what a gift for me to be able to step in. But I've been going, Danny asked me, you write some notes down? Yeah, for a month I've been writing notes down on what I'm going to say. Thank God I didn't write them onto paper. Your fourth step, you should do that. Write it on paper. My first fourth step, I did on lunch hour. First week, I've done about 5 4 steps now. That means I've done 5 fifth steps. 6, 7, 8. I've done 1,000 9s. Because I continue to show up. But the trick is it's not a perfect deal. I get, they call them epiphanies. And mine usually aren't good. Mine are, I've been doing that. I go to a meeting and hear somebody else say something. It's like, shit. Shouldn't have come to this meeting. Because now I got a bunch more shit to work on, right? I didn't know I was actually doing that. But now that I do, I can't get away from it. I can't escape from it. I've been doing that. And that's, you know, that's why I love meetings. I love being a sponsor. And it's not to help somebody else. My second divorce, she didn't love me no more. She didn't respect me. Right? But what happened is I went to less than zero. Spiritually, emotionally. And I'm sitting there after 5 days and not knowing where she is and where my daughter is. And it's Sunday night. They're supposed to be home, right? They're skiers. They're gone. And it's Sunday night. And I wasn't smart enough to know. This is a 3-day weekend. And it's midnight. I'm saying, what the fuck? Are they in Iraq? God, where are they at? Why can't she call me? Well, she didn't have any respect for me. What the hell did she need to call me for? She was perfectly fine. But in my head, and I'm thinking, you know, I got that life insurance, and it pays even with suicide. And then I thought, you know what? You're really in fucking trouble. You're in trouble right now. Your brain, your self-sponsoring brain, is trying to kill you one more time. And what are you going to do about it right now? And I had to surrender again at 26 years sober. Doesn't matter if you got a day, a week, a year, blah, blah, blah. When your brain takes back over and you lose that spiritual connection, come back and see us right here. Because that's what we're selling. It's the hope that there's tomorrow. And tomorrow I can fix the shit I may have done today. And that's my job today, is to get up tomorrow and fix the shit I did today. And I haven't had a lot to fix lately. I don't know. Maybe ask her. If you really want to do a good four step, ask your significant other to do one for you. Ask your enemy to do one for you. Because I see out of these eyes. It really, really takes a lot of work for me to see inward and to see just how screwed up I still am. And I've been around a long time, but it's still the best thing that's ever happened to me in my life. Because I have a guide, a blueprint. And I love to say that I have seemingly recovered from that hopeless state of mind and body. That doesn't mean I'm well, but I've recovered from that spot. And I still go back to that spot once in a while. But I've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I do it on a regular basis. And that's the joy for me of saying, I'm Alcoholic Andy. Thanks.